You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
I'm Calvin, and you're listening to Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. This show is an experiment in civility, gathering people who disagree to sit down face to face and having them discuss their disagreements. Do we ever arrive at consensus? Sometimes. What's most important is we've got the conversation started.
Well, hey, everybody. Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. I am your host, Calvin Moore. And per usual, I am here with my co-hosts, Kent Strait and Steve Phelps. What's going on, guys?
Hello, Calvin. How are you doing today?
I'm good. It's about week three of doing shows socially distanced, but I believe I just finished week four of working socially distanced. So I went and got some steaks for dinner today at the butcher. I don't go out often. My wife is still working out of the house.
So that's very cute that you go to a butcher. That's kind of old. My wife and I were just talking about that an hour ago about why is it everybody of that generation has a freezer in the basement and how do they get it down there? Because I don't know. Do you build the house around the freezer?
They did. I used to be a mover, a professional mover. Before I went to college, my last job before I went to college was being a professional mover. We had a guy who had a 1950s cast iron freezer in his basement. He called us just to move it out of the basement, paid us an exorbitant amount of money to do it. And I cannot tell you how much I felt my heart was going to burst in my chest trying to move that thing up the stairs. Mm-hmm. So yeah, absolutely. They built the house around that thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I went out today and it was odd. My wife works out of the house. So for her, it was normal. But for me, I've left my house twice in this last week. Once yesterday to get my daughter for visitation and then today to go get meat. Other than that, I hadn't left in a week. And before that, I hadn't left in a week. So it's just kind of a different world. It feels weird to be out and around other people and people wearing masks and things like that. How about you guys? How you guys been?
I don't want to make the quarantine all about me, but what our listeners don't know is
the shelter in place.
Sure. Yeah. What our listeners don't know is that for about 13 years, I have gotten my hair cut every 3 weeks without fail, and we are just entering week six, and it is driving me crazy. But I mean, you know, that's the smallest problem I have right now. So all is well.
Before I had money to go see a barber on a biweekly basis, my dad had an old pair of clippers from when he was in the Marine Corps, and he still has the I want to say also cast iron carrying case for that thing. And I just did a.
I'll tell you what.
There's a reason I'm wearing a hat.
If you would, you would do me this favor. If you would do me this favor, run an extension cord out of your house, leave the clippers on your porch, and I will come by. And
all right,
okay,
that's cool. So for the last few weeks, we have inadvertently been doing a series. Normally, we plan our series out ahead of time, but COVID-19 has made a series unto itself. The first week, we just kind of did a cross section of people who were affected by COVID-19. The second week we did an episode with, on the front half, it was students who have had their school year either all out canceled or at least majorly adjusted from in-person to online. And then we had teachers on the back half of that conversation. Last week we had on parents on the front half. And then the second half, we talked to people who are of a religious disposition to talk about major holidays such as Easter and Passover kind of being not canceled, but again, also having to move online. But one of the things we have not done, but this will finish out this series and we'll finish out our season, was talk to medical professionals. So everything we've talked about up until now, for the most part, with the exception of maybe teachers, talking about their practice as teachers, has been more anecdotal. Here is what has happened to me. Here are the stories I'm hearing. Things are very, very personal. Not saying that the people that we have on tonight, their stories aren't going to be personal. I know they're going to be intensely personal. But we wanted to bring on some medical professionals to speak about COVID from a medical standpoint, because I know there's so much out there to read, kind of delving through what is the media saying, what is this, I'm assuming medical professional on television saying, and then sifting through all the opinions that people have as well. I wanted to get people who actually are either experts in this area, are seeing patients who are dealing with this and are affected by this on a daily basis. So to that end, we have two people on for the front end of the show and possibly someone on for the second half of the show. We are still working on that. But we have Dr. Abdul El Sayed and Dr. Paul Thomas both on the line. I'm going to let you kind of introduce yourselves and give both of your bios. So that brings us to the first question. Tell us a little bit about yourself as a medical professional. How long have you been a medical professional, and do you have a specialized area of focus?
Paul, go ahead. Yeah, so my name is Paul Thomas. I'm a family medicine physician. I finished my residency in 2016, and I started a practice where I take care of patients directly. I leave the insurance companies out of our medical service, so my patients pay me essentially a membership that starts at $10 a month for kids and starts at $49 a month for adults. And with that membership, my patients can reach out to me anytime they need me, and I lower the cost of care by getting people wholesale medications and at-cost labs and at-cost imaging services. We're really trying to reduce the cost of care and make healthcare affordable and accessible for everyone in our community.
And Paul, you're describing a concierge practice?
It is not.
It is not. Okay. That's what I thought that was, but you can correct me.
Yeah. We call it direct primary care because we're delivering primary care directly to our patients. And concierge, you need to have some sort of underlying insurance product to be a member of a concierge practice. In our practice, roughly 35% to 40% of our patients are uninsured. They're simply shut out of the typical health insurance system and don't have access to care. And by paying us a monthly membership, they now have access to a physician.
Okay. And to your credit, one, I want you to obviously say the name of your practice. We are here in Southeastern Michigan, but to your credit, I recall one, when you were starting, you and I kind of having a conversation about this. I remember how novel of an idea it seemed to me. It almost harkened back to me, like, you know, Little House on the Prairie, the doctor shows up at your house, that kind of thing, right? That was what I was thinking. But even more so, to your credit, was I remember not having insurance. I now have a job where I'm gainfully employed. I can work from home. I still have my insurance. So it's not an issue for me at this point. But I remember not having insurance and having a conversation with you about, okay, here's what I offer. And I had never had that kind of conversation, one-on-one with the doctor. And two, I didn't know something like that existed. So what's the name of your practice, just so people know who are listening?
Yeah, we're called Plum Health and Plum Health DPC. We're in Corktown, right on Michigan Avenue at the old Tiger Stadium site. Okay. We're at the corner, if you will. And I think for you, Calvin, a lot of people fall in that similar situation where if you're a freelancer or work at a restaurant, you know, as a bartender or a waiter or drive a truck or cut hair, you probably make more than $17,000 a year, which is the cutoff for Medicaid here in Michigan. But you may not make enough to purchase private insurance that could run you $300 or $400 or sometimes even $800 a month, depending on your comorbidities and health history.
Okay, thanks. Dr. Sayed.
Yeah, my name is Dr. Abdul El Sayed. I am a physician, epidemiologist, progressive activist. Most folks, if you've heard my name before, it's because I ran for governor of Michigan. Before that, I was the health commissioner for the city of Detroit. I also host a podcast called America Dissected, where we go beyond the headlines to talk about what matters in health. And our season right now is focused entirely on COVID-19. We talk to experts and activists at the front lines of this. So, you know, upcoming episodes with Andrew Yang and Bernie Sanders. We've had Representative Primala Jayapal on, and then a number of experts who do this work day in and day out. I don't practice medicine, but as the former health commissioner for the city, my focus has been on public health and in particular health disparities. I also just wrote a book that came out in the middle of a pandemic. Imagine being an epidemiologist who wrote a book about an epidemic in the middle of an epidemic. And that's
sounds a little suspicious, doctor.
Yeah, you know, I'm trying to stay on brand. You know,
right? Yeah, it's like How are we going to sell this book? Oh, I know.
I've got it. Well done.
Yeah. I guess there's no laughing matter, but you got to laugh to keep from crying right now, right?
That's exactly it, right? That's the thing, is that you got to find the humor. I honestly also just have to say, like, kudos to the internet, because I just have to say, like, coronavirus humor is inspired, right? Mm-hmm. I just feel like it took the best humor to get us through the worst pandemic in modern American history. But the book is called Healing Politics. I actually just signed a bunch of copies for Pages Bookshop. So if you're looking to go to a place to pick it up, Pages on the Ave or Source Booksellers are carrying it, and I hope that you'll.
I was about to say, is it at Source? Because Pages is like on the west side of Detroit. I wanted to go all the way over there just to get a copy.
Yeah, so you got Pages, you got Source. If you're outside of the city, then maybe check out Literati in Ann Arbor or Nicola's.
And Literati has raised quite a bit of money to kind of help their workers right now through this as well. I was just there literally like maybe a week and a half before all the shelter in place orders kind of came down across the country. But that being said, Ken, next question.
I was just going to say, let me point out, Abdul was good enough to leave all the CNN off of his bio because he's been all over TV.
Did see that. He's kind of a big deal. He did drop. Oh, we got Bernie Sanders and Andrew Yang coming on in the next couple of weeks. So, kind of cool.
So healthcare,
a little sprinkle in there.
Healthcare being an issue that is on everybody's mind right now. What would you say are the glaring issues, outstanding issues surrounding healthcare as you understand it?
I'll kick that one off. I think the biggest glaring issue is that our corporate medical system is really destroying the practice of medicine as we know it, in terms of forcing physicians to see more and more patients in less and less time. And it's removing physician autonomy and physician control from the practice of medicine. And we're seeing some horrendous outcomes in terms of the coronavirus pandemic and our response to it, because these corporate healthcare systems, large hospital systems, they're incentivized to do outpatient surgeries that are lucrative, procedural work. And because of the coronavirus, they've had a huge loss of revenue and they're cutting their staff, cutting their employees. They don't have PPE for their employees, and they have a limited number of ventilators because there's no future planning for a pandemic, because that's not what fuels their bottom line. Pandemics and being ready for disasters is not built into their profit or their business plan. So I think we're seeing a lot of gaps in the healthcare system because of this pandemic. It's kind of laying bare our current healthcare system.
So let me ask you this question, Dr. Thomas. First, can you define, and I guess a 2-second Google search would define it for me, but people are lazy. PPE, what are those? I keep seeing it. Like, hospitals don't have PPEs. What does that mean?
That's your personal protective equipment. Those are gowns, gloves, masks, N95 masks, face shields, hair nets, et cetera, that protect our nurses, doctors, mid-level providers, respiratory therapists from contracting the coronavirus.
Okay. Thank you for that. And then on the other side of things, you said, hey, this is a global pandemic. Pandemic is not built into essentially their financial model, right?
Exactly.
Kind of from a person who's never been through, none of us have been through a global pandemic unless you were born in like 1918. Even those people don't remember, they were babies. But
they're also 102.
Right.
Yeah.
Very few people alive, no one alive that I can think of, remembers having gone through a global pandemic. So I guess the question for me is, how can a hospital plan for something of this scope? And maybe I could throw this to you, Dr. El-Sayed, since you're an epidemiologist as well. Should that be an expectation of hospitals to plan for something like that? Because I wouldn't know. I would think, I don't know how you didn't plan for this, but on the other hand, I'm like, how does anybody plan for this?
Well, let me jump in. I agree entirely with Dr. Thomas, and his practice is a really, really unique solution to a set of problems that we've had for a really long time. But those problems are deep. And let me just sort of step in and think a little bit about how the system works for a second, and maybe it'll be a little bit more clear to answer your question.
Thank you.
You think about how a doctor's office or a hospital gets paid, right? If you're lucky enough to be insured, you spend a certain amount of money, and your employer spends a certain amount of money, sends it over to the insurance company, right? One of 7,000 in the United States. And then when you get sick, they're supposed to pay the doctor or the hospital who took care of you. The problem with that, though, is that the cost of care has gone up and up and up and up and up and up. And that's largely driven by the fact that at this point, there's really no incentive to bring costs down, because you're not the one paying for your actual healthcare. The insurance companies are. And they know that you pay a certain amount every time. So if you get sick, they're just going to, instead of trying to negotiate down the cost of healthcare, they're going to charge you this extra thing we call a deductible, right? The amount of money you have to pay to even get access to the health insurance you already paid for. And every hospital is asking questions about its bottom line. It's saying, how do we make sure that we are as profitable as possible so our CEO and our C-suite gets as big of a bonus as possible? Nobody really has an incentive to either bring down costs for you or to think about the bigger picture of how do we prevent people from getting sick or make sure that we're ready to take care of them as it stands. So if you're running your hospital like a business, right, every management consultant will tell you, give you a couple basic pieces of advice. They'll tell you, listen, you don't want to carry any quote unquote overhead. So you got to fill to 95 to 96% capacity every single night. Make sure your beds are filled. Don't include any more beds that go unfilled, because that's money you're not making, right? They'll also say, for all of your supplies, the PPE that Dr. Thomas defined for you, for all of those supplies, make sure you don't have any extra, right? Because you should be using what we call just-in-time supply, right? You should be using it just as you get it, so you don't waste any time and any money on including extra supply. But if you think about it, right, a hospital's basic purpose beyond making itself money should be to take care of sick people. And we know, we've been talking about, right? Epidemiologists have been saying, there's like a lot of clips of Dr. Fauci out there saying, well, before this ever happened, that it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. So if our healthcare system wasn't so focused on a bottom line, on making money, maybe it wouldn't follow terrible advice when it comes to what might happen in the middle of a global pandemic. And here we are, we're hit by a global pandemic. None of the hospitals have the beds they need. We don't have the PPE we need. And they're fighting both COVID-19 and bankruptcy at the same time, because they've got to cancel all of their elective procedures, which are where they make all of their money, right? And so you've got places like Beaumont, right? You've got places like Henry Ford. You got places like the DMC, who are now fighting bankruptcy at the same time they're trying to ramp up for COVID-19, right? And have actually, I don't know which of these hospitals, so I don't want to say anything about any specific hospital, but there have been hospitals in Metro Detroit who are literally laying off doctors and nurses in the middle of a goddamn pandemic, right? So if this doesn't say what's broken about a healthcare system, I don't know what does.
And thank you for thank you both for your answers on that, because again, for like I say this all the time on the show, I'm a historian by background. So if you want to talk to me about history, I'm all about it. You want to talk about the 1918 influenza? I'm your man. But when it comes to how hospitals work now, or how many things work now, this is why I bring on experts. And so for me, on the outside looking in, like I know Steve kind of works in and around this industry, but from the outside looking in, I'm going, why is a hospital laying people off right now? It seems like they should have plenty of work. And then like to what you were saying just there, you know, people, elective surgeries, those people are no longer necessary, but they're still nurses, but they're no longer necessary for this pandemic.
They're absolutely necessary.
Oh, okay.
It's that they can't be paid. It's that the care for a COVID-19 patient, if you're an insurance company, you just don't bill that high relative to, you name it, knee replacement, hip replacement, some sort of dermatologic procedure. And so it's a mismatch in terms of the need, right? And the economic value. And so like in our for-profit healthcare system, we have said that the highest value care is elective procedures. When this pandemic is showing us that that's just completely bullshit. right? The highest value care is saving a COVID-19 patient's life right now. But because our incentives are so messed up, there's really no incentive to do that. So literally laying off nurses and doctors who could be doing that work in the middle of a pandemic, because the incentives of the system most of the time tell us that that's not as valuable as the rest of it.
Okay. Calvin, let me jump in real quick right here.
Yeah.
So in this question is for either doctor. Right now, the motivations for these hospitals are the bottom line. Do either of you have any strategies for changing that motivation, a different way to incentivize hospitals to treat sick people and not about meeting that bottom line?
So Dr. T, throw me the alley-oop, okay?
Well, if you read Dr. Abdul El-Sayed's most recent book, Healing Politics, he's laid it out in essentially like a 16-point plan if you get through the whole thing. And he talks about, why our for-profit health insurance system is ruining medical care in our country. And, I'll throw you the alley-oop here, Dr. Abdul. Why don't you take it from here?
Hashtag Medicare for all.
Never heard of it. I don't know what you're talking about.
a little known plan. So basically, remember I told you had 7,000 health insurances and you had unknown amount of doctors and hospitals. The big problem in our healthcare system right now is that because each of these health insurers is run for profit, they have really no incentive to focus us on the real bottom line, which should be people's health. Instead, they're all focused on their bottom line. All of the doctors and hospitals are focused on their bottom line. And in fact, what they're able to do is come together and negotiate prices so that the biggest of them, the biggest hospitals and the biggest health insurers, benefit most. Have you guys noticed how the number of hospitals keeps dwindling because they keep buying each other up? That has everything to do with the ways that the big hospitals can negotiate better reimbursement rates from the big insurance companies.
Right. Another question.
Let me jump in here.
I'm seeing hospitals dwindle, but, and again, this is just me outside looking in, like St. John Hospital is now part of Ascension, right?
That's right.
St. John Hospital didn't close, so we don't have less hospitals. We have less big, we have less hospital systems, but not less hospitals, right?
We have more consolidation.
Okay.
Right. In the system. So in effect, what you end up having is micro oligopolies. Right? Local oligopolies. And just to explain the term, what I mean by oligopolies, right? So you think about a good market for any good, right? Anything that you want to buy, you want to have a whole bunch of providers, right? Because those providers are then forced to negotiate with each other and bring the price down. But right now, what we end up having is what's called market consolidation. So hospitals are buying each other up, which creates only a few options. So you're forced basically to go to one of very few. I know Dr. Thomas has some perspectives on this issue.
Well, it's also happening on the primary care side. A lot of times, let's say 30, 40 years ago, if you were a family medicine physician, you finish your residency, you go out and you hang a shingle, meaning you set up your own independent practice and you take care of people in your community. And sometimes you can lower the cost of care by giving people breaks and helping people out and negotiating for better lab prices or better imaging prices. You might have an x-ray machine in your building. You might only charge people $5 or $10 for an x-ray. Now, doctors are forced into the corporate practice of medicine where their practices are consolidating and being sold to the big umbrella system to be a part of that system, and it reduces the competition. And what Dr. El-Sayed was saying about the insurance companies negotiating with the hospital systems, you have to have an army of billers and coders on each side negotiating penny for penny, and that increases the overall cost spend. When you pay for healthcare, Dr. Abdul, you can give me the exact percentage, but a lot of your money is going to the healthcare administrators who are haggling over the prices on labs and imaging, et cetera. And that is why I don't bill or use insurance, and that is why I can lower the cost of healthcare for my individual patients, because I'm no longer having to hire three people just to bill and code so I get paid from an insurance company. I can just deliver care to my patients and not have that high overhead so I can lower my cost of care overall.
Do we think that, and this might be a slight bit of repeat of the question Steve just asked, but with in light of COVID-19, in light of everything that has happened, and I know you gave the shout out, Dr. Syed to El Syed to Medicare for All. Do we think that hospitals retool after this, or do we think that Medicare for All, from a as a movement in the United States, do we think that those things get a push after something like this, or do we go back to business as usual once life gets back to quote unquote normal?
So this is a question. This is a decision that we all got to make, because you know there's a reason I went from medical school to public health to running for office. It's because I realized that so many of the choices that shape people's health have a lot less to do with the technical questions about how we provide good healthcare, and a lot more to do with the moral and political questions about how, as a society, we choose to value everybody. And our healthcare system just doesn't do that right now. And this is a choice. I mean, I think more than anything else, I hope that people are starting to appreciate that COVID-19 is showing us that we are all as vulnerable as the most vulnerable person. We are all as exposed as the most exposed person. The question is whether or not we want to operationalize that into our politics and make a choice that says that nobody in our society, in the richest, most powerful country in the world, should go without basic health insurance, that we shouldn't be asking hospitals to run as for-profit corporations as if we don't need them in the middle of a goddamn pandemic. And the recognition that who has suffered most tend to be people who have been on the slippery edge of our economic, political, and social system for a really long time, right? You think about the disparities that we've seen, shameful, but not surprising, right? Who in America is most likely to have to work a job that takes them out of the house in the middle of a pandemic? Who in America is more likely to have to go without healthcare and go without a doctor because those doctors don't live in their communities because most of them, if they have insurance, are on Medicaid? Who in America is most likely to lose a job when the economy turns south? Tend to be Black Americans, tend to be low-income Americans. And so this is about a choice that we have to make politically. And I don't know if we're going to make that choice, but I know for damn sure that we have a responsibility to be making this argument, because you know the way to deal with a pandemic is never to have a pandemic in the first place, is to make a set of decisions that leave people so that they're not so vulnerable when something bad happens, and you know, a set of decisions about investing in basic public infrastructure so that you can see these things coming, respond, and not have to then suffer 40,000 deaths. I mean, I just want to put this out there. 40,000 people have died of COVID-19 in the last 3 months since it hit. That's like having a 9/11 attack every 10 days for 3 months, right? So the question that we have to answer is like, are we willing to, you know, invest in hashtag never again and do all the things that we need to protect ourselves, right? Because think about the response that we had to 9/11. That was 3,000 people who died. This is 40,000 people who died. One 9/11 every 10 days for 3 months. Are we willing to do the same thing?
But Dr. Syed, I don't think you understand. I want to take my boat out, and I've never grown corn, but this year was my year. This was my year. We'll get to that at the end. Kent has a question about telehealth.
I do actually. I just wanted to, because obviously every question we have here is going to mention the pandemic. Let me ask you this, Dr. Syed. You mentioned that that people started talking about a pandemic as if it was an issue of a matter of when and not if. I am 44 years old, and 2014, so 6 years ago, when Barack Obama mentioned a possible pandemic coming, it was the first time I had ever posited the idea. That's the first time it ever floated across my mind in my entire life. And since the Spanish flu was the last major one, I mean, smallpox was a problem, a couple generations ago. Why? 95 years ago, why 5 years ago did we start thinking about this as an inevitability? Did something change?
Oh, I mean, people have been saying it's an inevitability for decades now. The problem is that here's the hard part about public health. If public health succeeds, then nothing bad happens, right? Because you didn't hear about it, because we took care of it. And when public health fails, everybody's like, where was public health? So you're screwed either way. Right? Either terrible things happen in the world, or you fix them, you solve them. Nobody knows how it got solved or that it was even an issue on the front end anyway. And then people are like, what do we need public health for? So yep. This has been a conversation that's been being had in the public health world for a long, long time. The problem is that the way we pay attention to issues tends to leave us only asking, right, what happened, rather than how do we prevent something bad from happening? And so, like, here we are, right? We're in a situation where we have cut and cut and cut public health. If I told you the funding numbers, right, the degree of funding cuts, over the past 15 years in local public health, we've seen a 45% across the board cut in state and local public health, right? You look at the CDC budget, you look at the HHS budget, it has not met the need in terms of the growth of the economy for a long time. And so we cut and cut and cut because you got folks like Donald Trump who come in and be like, what is this for, right? It's like reaching in your engine and then pulling out pipes and being like, I don't know what it does, right? Because the hood's down and you don't see it working, right? So you pull it out and then when the thing stops and your car goes up in a ball of flame, you're like, I wonder why. We couldn't have seen it coming.
I wouldn't trust him with my car either. Let's just be very clear on that.
Okay. Back to the scheduled question. In 2019, we first started to hear a term a lot, and telehealth, and it was considered part of the future of medical care. However, the current pandemic has accelerated the progress and use of telehealth services. For our listeners who don't know what that is, and I only learned a few months ago, it's the ability to consult a physician or nurse practitioner over a video device. So you're welcome. Do you see a time in the near future when telehealth successfully or essentially replaces in-person office visits for routine services?
I will take that. This is Dr. Thomas here with Plum Health talking.
And I was just on your website, and it appears that you use it quite a bit.
Yes, we do.
Okay.
And here's why. We don't bill or use insurance. Therefore, we have a lot of flexibility in how we deliver care. Because an insurance company mandates that they will not pay you unless you have a face-to-face visit with your doctor. So a lot of insurance-based physicians are scrambling in how they're going to get paid, how they're going to pay their employees in the time of COVID-19. When patients can't safely come to the office. For us, we've continued to run as usual, but we've switched to like 95% telehealth, where we text, we email, we have video conversations when necessary, and we have a lot of phone calls. And we've been doing this for the last 4 years. And the more doctors that adopt this direct primary care model of practice, the more and more Americans are going to be embracing quote unquote telehealth. Because as long as your patient, as long as my patients waive my obligation to their HIPAA rights, I'm able to communicate with them clearly via text, emails, phone calls, etc. There are even some HIPAA compliant software that you can get into, but again, that adds to the cost of care and inflates the cost of care for my patients. So I've made a decision to use what people use and use Gmail and texting, SMS, etc. So I think we're going to see more and more people using telehealth, but right now it's not a great solution for long-term viability because there is so much information that you can get from a physical examination with your patient. What we're doing right now is really a temporary fix, doing a lot more telehealth. If I had it my way, I'd see every patient face-to-face because it really does help with the physical examination for new concerns. Now, a lot of things you can do asynchronously with texting, following up on issues, making sure things improve over time. But if somebody has a new concern that you don't have a 100% clear diagnosis on, the physical exam can be very important, as well as getting lab work, like doing blood draws, doing ultrasounds in the office, and sending people out for imaging.
Dr. Thomas, let me follow up and ask about a specific granular question. I have never had a telehealth appointment, but I'm thinking about the things that I usually go to the doctor for, and it's usually a cough or a sore throat. And I mean, assuming that I engage in a telehealth appointment using my iOS device, does the camera on that allow you to see down my throat and prescribe something?
It's not perfect. We can, sometimes I ask my patients who say they have a sore throat to text a picture of their tonsils, the back of their throat. And if they have pus discharge, that's clear to see on the photo. sure, we can, you know, use some amoxicillin as long as you're not allergic. However, you know, there's other things that should be done. I should get your vital signs. I should get your temperature. I should get your blood pressure. Should check your height and weight, those kind of things. I should also feel your lymph nodes in your neck, make sure there's nothing enlarged there. And, you know, listen to your heart and lungs for good measure, just to be thorough. So that's the value of the physical exam in the office. You're getting a lot more information. You're checking up on things and getting a better picture, fuller picture of your patient that way.
Yeah, and I want to keep this moving because I want to be aware of both of your time. We only have about 20 minutes left. Kent, Steve, just so you all are aware, the ICU nurse had pretty rough day. She's a little worked up. She's not going to come on for the back half. But I also want to be respectful of our guest time here on what would have only been the front hour. So
we will spend the second hour talking about Game of Thrones.
So yes, on to, yes, and how terrible the last question. Episode was.
Yes.
Okay. No, who do you think Jon Snow is?
No, before the next question, Dr. Thomas, I'm very intrigued by this. I work for, and this might not apply to your general clientele, because you said, hey, you know, if you are a you know, in the service industry or you're a barber, these are people who generally don't have a healthcare plan through their employer. They don't have a 401k plan through their employer. So this might not necessarily apply, but my employer says, hey, once a year, go get a physical, don't smoke, and we'll give you X amount of dollars off your healthcare plan. Not exactly sure exactly how it works because I stay pretty good health. I don't have to go to the doctor very often, but I at least have to go once a year for my yearly physical. You say there's a value to coming into the office. Obviously, you can do more, but could something like a routine yearly physical be done via telehealth, or is that something that
you can get a lot of the physical exam done through, or a lot of the annual physical, quote unquote, through telehealth? You can talk about smoking cessation. You can talk about good health habits like diet and exercise, and you can also coordinate for the person to go to the nearest laboratory for a blood draw, check the cholesterol and other important markers. But unless they have a blood pressure cuff at home, you're missing some key information. Unless you have if you have a scale at home, I think everybody does, you can get some honest reporting on their height and weight and all that kind of stuff that can help with their BMI and your counseling there. But there's something to be said for listening to somebody's heart and lungs, especially if they have a concern, or addressing any concerns that come up. And there's some subtle things that might come up as well. There's really important things around depression screening that can happen in the office. And then also making sure people are safe. So domestic violence is not something we talk about often, but it's something that we should discuss every time we have somebody coming to the office, and making sure that they feel safe at home and that they have a safe space that they can enter into away from other family members that might be harming them or threatening them, where they could discuss those issues in private with a physician who could then intervene and help them out in those situations. So there's value to the doctor-patient relationship that goes just beyond, writing some numbers down on a piece of paper. There's the emotional connection and also that trusting relationship that you may not be able to build as well through a telehealth platform.
Now, I have found quite a bit, and maybe Dr. El Sayed can jump in on this point, kind of the bigger global issue of healthcare. I work in the healthcare industry, and I find that when the ACA came along, there were some of the essential services. One was an office visit, for instance. But the company I worked for noticed that even though people had primary care physicians and they had these essential visits, they still use the ER and they still use the urgent care quite a bit. And I think what that came down to is these are the average $8, $9, $10 an hour employee has to take time out of their pay per hour, their hourly pay, to go to a doctor that's available in the middle of the day, in which case they're going to say, I can't do that. That's $30, $40 that I need. I can't do that. My employer won't let me take the time off. I don't have PTO at my job. And so we saw that even though this was available to a lot of people weren't able to utilize it because doctors work 9 to 5 or 8:30 to 4:30 or, you know, whatever the hours might be. So is telehealth a way that you're your average person that might not be able to take PTO in the middle of the day because they just can't afford it or their job doesn't allow it, is telehealth something that can, if it's expanded, reach out to those people and really allow them to get ahead of the game, so to speak, when it comes to their own health?
Dr. Paul, you wanna take that, and I'll jump it on the back end.
Sorry. I really built my practice around being accommodating for everyone in my community. And so I do have really high income folks who can skip over on lunch break. And then I have really low income folks who can't miss an hour of their regular day job. So sometimes I'll come in at 8 a.m. so that my lower income folks can make their job at 9 a.m. And sometimes I'll stay till 6 or even 7 o'clock to accommodate folks like that. And I do use telehealth to help people in that way as well. You know, some people have transportation or mobility issues. So if they can do a visit over the phone, if they have the blood pressure cuff their house, and if I can mail them their medications, that could save them a lot of time and hassle around traveling and missing their regular job.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, as a physician that's connected with my patients compassionately, those are the things that I've tried to weave into my practice so that I can be holistic in my approach to the community.
Yeah. And the only thing I would add is, like, we should just have paid time off, right? Like that
sounds like a novel idea, there,
right? It's like, you know, I mean, if you just think about this for a second, right? Right now, we all know that we're social distancing so that nobody spreads coronavirus to each other. And the coronavirus is very different from the flu, the cold, and all of these other diseases for a couple of reasons. Number one, there's no baseline immunity that we have to it. There's no treatment for it. There's no immunization for it. It's happening all at once. We don't know anything about it because it's only been in humanity for 6 months. A lot of differences. But the flu is still a deadly disease, right? The cold is not as deadly, but like also just not fun and nobody wants it. So like the idea that we tell people that they have to go to work even if they're sick is just not great for anybody's health. It's not good for the person who has to go to work because being sick sucks and you should probably be able to just stay home, drink fluids, and, you know, wash your hands. But going to work means now you're engaging with literally everyone else at work, because our policy in this country is that if you get sick, you got to go to work and make everyone else sick too. That's our policy. So like paid time off should just be an obvious thing. And I hope that this is one of those choices that we make coming out of this pandemic, right? That should have been like a gee whiz kind of idea, right? That should seem really obvious now. If we're telling everybody to socially distance to protect each other from an infectious disease, shouldn't we at least, when we're not in the middle of a pandemic, let people who are sick socially distance so they protect everyone from the disease? Just kind of obvious.
Yeah. I want to jump to a question on that was supposed to be for the back half of the show. And Dr. Syed, I want to do another interview with you directly about your book, but it just seems like we're going to have to call an audible because we're running out of time here in terms of the questions that we asked, but we're going to do a secondary interview if you will come back specifically about your book, because all three of us have been reading it and I'd like to actually get some questions in about that as well. But since we have been focusing on COVID-19 and the response on that, you brought up a little bit earlier in the interview about kind of like the discrepancies, the disparity in healthcare, especially along racial lines, which tends to be my area of focus. So I majored in African American history. So anything from the beginning of the nation up to and including the Civil War, if it has to do with Black people, I tend to be like the historian that's called in to talk about that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. And I tend to be a person who someone, if I'm going to go on the news, I need somebody to research this for me, I'll do that for them. Mm-hmm. So I'm a big fan of Ibram Kendi, who is the director of anti-racist research and Policy Center at American University. But the Washington Post analysis found that majority Black communities had infection rates 3 times the rate of majority white communities. A CDC analysis of nearly 1,500 hospitalizations across 14 states found that Black people made up a third of the hospitalizations, despite accounting for 18% of the population in the areas studied. So in a recent article by Ibram Kendi, he suggests that, quote, America is facing a racial pandemic within the viral pandemic, unquote. What's your perspective on the disparity? And I'd like, obviously, Dr. El Sayed, I'd like your point of view based on the comments that that you made earlier. And then Dr. Thomas, I would love your commentary as well, working predominantly in the largest African-American city by population currently. So
do you mind if I kick that off here? Yeah, no particular order. I just think that, you know, the main reason I started my practice in Detroit is because of the health disparity and the difference in availability of primary care physicians in Detroit and versus like Oakland County. So let's say there's one primary care physician for every 6,000 residents in the city of Detroit proper. And if you go north of 8 Mile into Oakland County, there's one primary care physician for every 600 residents. So it's a 10x disparity.
You're saying, let's say, isn't it? That is
exactly how it is. Okay. And so this is why I started my practice in Detroit. This is why I exist to serve and to try to take on these health disparities head on. And you're right. You know, the city, the state of Michigan has a African-American population of roughly 14%, and African-Americans have seen 40% of the infections and 40% of the fatalities from COVID-19. And that pattern is held across many regions across our nation. So in Chicago, African-Americans make up 30% of the population, but have been 70% of the deaths in Chicago, and that those same stats hold in the state of Louisiana. And so Dr. El-Sayed is going to elaborate on this, but my take is that what the pandemic shows is the weakness in our infrastructure across so many different socioeconomic layers and health system and healthcare delivery. And it just really brings into focus the inequalities in our system.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. As an epidemiologist, I was taught that you've got to zoom out beyond the pathogen, and you've got to ask about the host, and you've got to ask about the environment. And what we've had in America for a very long time is an environment that is shaped by structural racism and the policy choices we as a society have made about discriminating against people because of the color of their skin, that has been systematically beating up on the host, making them substantially more vulnerable to a disease like this. And that occurs in a number of ways, right? Again, think about just baseline, the probability of having an underlying condition. Detroiters face threefold the probability of asthma hospitalization. COVID kills by in effect closing your lungs down. That's how asthma kills too. The idea that people who suffer disproportionately from asthma are going to suffer more when they get COVID-19, that's obvious. Think about diabetes. Think about hypertension. Think about heart disease. All of them, 2 to 3 times higher rates in Black Americans versus White Americans. And then step out from there, right? What is the thing we're all telling people to do? Stay home. But staying home is a privilege. If you work an $11 an hour job in the back of a kitchen, $11 an hour job driving a bus, right? You're quote unquote essential. Right. But the fact of the matter is that we have deemed people who are now essential, right? We have deemed them expendable for a very long time. And what we're saying right now is also you're expendable. And who tends to work those jobs systematically? And then think about access to baseline health care. Think about access to public health. My job in 2015 was to rebuild a health department that had been shut down when the city of Detroit was facing bankruptcy. Do you know of any other major city in the country that had its health department shut down? Privatized out. So we're dealing with a health department that's functionally 5 years old. And then think about the circumstance leading up. We had 8 years of a governorship where our governor, despite a vote of the people, thought it was okay to pass a law that could not be repealed after it was repealed once, that basically systematically took away the right to self-determination from people in cities and or school districts that they thought were being economically derelict. But what does that mean? That means that at some point, more than 50% of Black Michiganders were living under an emergency manager that was appointed by the governor. And then think also about why these cities or these school districts went under because of white flight. All of a sudden, you had a mass exodus, right, of all of the richest people in society, made systematically richer because of who got access to jobs, who got access to the best housing, who got access to the means of wealth, all of which, right, frame this system that leaves people exposed right now. And so this is about public policy and about the ways that systematic public policies shape people's lives and livelihoods, the ways that it imprints itself on people's bodies and the vulnerability it leaves them in the setting of a virus. So viruses don't discriminate. That's something people love to say. You're right. Viruses do not discriminate, but people do. And that's why viruses hurt some people worse than others.
So right now there seem to be two schools of thought. There's a thought that social distancing guidelines and lockdowns are just right. And then there's a thought that the social distancing guidelines are ineffective at best and an infringement of our constitutional freedoms at worst. As you might have known, there was a recent rally in Lansing, Michigan, which made national headlines for the protest. What is your perspective, either of your, both of you, what is your perspective as a medical professional?
Yeah, I'm just imagining like Ben Franklin out here. Just like, I'm just imagining the sort of face palm emoji with a powdered wig. Being like, yo, we didn't say this shit so you all will come back here and like protest so you could buy some goddamn fertilizer in the middle of a goddamn pandemic, right? I mean, just like, what? Look, social distancing is what we have to do right now to reduce the spread of disease. I know it's hard. I'm not saying that it's not. And yes, there are economic consequences to it. But just think about what we just said. Think about the question in juxtaposition to the question we just asked, right? I mean, there are people who can't stay home because they're working jobs that they have to work because we've said that they're essential. Those aren't the folks who are out there protesting, even though they'd have every right to be them, right? So I mean, just think about what it says about inequality in our society, where you got folks protesting because they want to buy some damn fertilizer, right? Meanwhile, we've got a pandemic that is affecting low-income Black folks worst. And these folks protesting actively makes this pandemic worse. I mean, this pandemic has, what it's done is almost like shined a light on the crevices and the inequities in our society and forced them to take a really broad look at them. So social distancing matters. We need to keep doing it because at this point, the risk of another spike is exceedingly damaging. And I know it's hard and it has economic consequences. And I'm not going to take that away from anybody. But so far, it's killed 40,000 people in America. And I think we all have a responsibility to do our part to protect each other. And so even if you wanted to, quote unquote, open back up, right? Like, what does that look like? Do you think everybody's just going to all of a sudden be like, well, Donald Trump said I can go out. I guess I'm fine. No, because at this point, there's still a pandemic raging and we see the numbers grow every day. And so these folks who are protesting, I think, have forgotten that in a moment like this, we've got to put science and we've got to put smart policy ahead of what is like just shameful politics. And, you know, never mind what Donald Trump is saying and has said about this. It is exceedingly damaging and exceedingly damning to his leadership, quote unquote, that he's saying and in doing these things. That is actively putting people in harm's way.
I would just note as a non-doctor that I heard a statistic today about quote unquote opening up, and that is Sweden right now is open, and the movie theaters are seeing 7% of their previous attendance and 5% of their previous restaurant attendance. So opening up isn't going to bring anything back.
So now Trump wants to be like Sweden?
Dr. Thomas, we'll let you land the plane, and then we'll close this out.
I'm landing a plane? Sorry. Yeah, guys. Yeah.
All of a sudden, you're a pilot.
Maybe we'll use another edge. Closing up the sutures.
There we go. Yeah, Dr. Thomas.
Yeah, I think when I look at those protests in Lansing, I understand, you have to understand where those people are coming from. Like the people who are out there protesting have obviously been hurt by the economics of all of this. And maybe they're living in rural communities that haven't been as acutely affected by the pandemic as our urban communities have. As we know, here in Michigan, the majority of the cases have been in Detroit, Wayne County, Oakland County, Washtenaw County, Macomb County, et cetera. And perhaps somebody living on the other side of the state hasn't experienced the number of deaths or a close relative dying or many friends dying from coronavirus like we in Detroit have experienced. And so maybe they're coming at this from a different lens. So, you know, we have to give people the benefit of the doubt here. And perhaps they're listening to a different news cycle or different, you know, more conservative news channel. But all that being said, you know, perhaps there are 1,000, 2,000 Michigan residents out there protesting from a state of roughly 10 million people. It just goes to show that the vast majority, and I'll borrow a term from the conservative movement, the silent majority is at home observing the coronavirus shutdown, protecting their families, doing what they can to survive, and doing what they can to flatten the curve and help their fellow Michiganders out. And I think the majority of our state is doing the right thing. And perhaps we have got a few thousand people who are getting egged on or concerned about their economic futures who are lashing out and in a kind of a negative way. But overall, I think we're all rowing the same direction, trying to improve the state of affairs in Michigan by limiting the spread of this virus. And we're all doing what we can.
Well, Dr. El Sayed, Dr. Thomas, I do appreciate both of you taking some time out to, I mean, what else were we going to do? But no, I guess you guys are busier than we are. But I do appreciate both of you coming on to give your perspective from a medical position. I think it's been fantastic, and it kind of a nice bow on this series that we've just been doing. I do, of course, hope both of you stay well, stay healthy. Again, Dr. Thomas, you're seeing patients right now, so you're probably one. You know, hats off to you being a frontline medical practitioner right now. But I do thank you both for being here. Also, thank you to our listeners. Thanks so much for listening to Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. Make sure you're checking out our website, leadingquestionsnow.com, where you can find all of our episodes from this season and the last now six seasons, because this is the season finale of season six. Bios, a calendar of upcoming topics, and even suggest topics for us to talk about. If you're interested in bringing our program out to your college, university, or organization once that all opens back up and it's safe for all of us to do that, email us at hello@leadingquestionsnow.com. We'll get back to you. Don't forget, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and of course the Podcast Detroit app. Leave us a review, and we will see you next season. Thanks so much.